Hey, what's going on? It's at the letters for Tuesday, June the 3rd, 2025. Arden Swelling, Ben Nicholson Smith, Christian Ryan is producing. You're all listening. Thanks to everybody that I just mentioned. Ben, Blue Jays coming off of a four-game series with the Oakland Athletics in which they averaged just shy of 10 runs per game, won the series with a plus 21 run differential, 1152 OPS on the series for Blue Jays hitters. If you had to assign percentages to how much of those results over the four games could be chalked up to how well the Blue Jays played and the quality of competition, what would those percentages look like?
You're trying to take away from their best series of the season here.
I haven't taken anything away. You're the one who's going to take something away. I just posed a question. You could say 100 to 0. That's on the table.
That would not be entirely accurate because we all saw the Oakland Athletics, or I guess now just the Athletics, come into town and play some just not great baseball. Fundamentally, I mean, they were making defensive mistakes. The caliber of their pitching clearly leaves a lot to be desired. I really like the top five in that lineup. Jacob Wilson is such a fun player. He's going to have a lot of four-hit games and 12-8 losses for the Athletics this year. But yeah, to answer your question, I'll give the Jays 75% credit because you still got to go out there and you still have to do your job. And they did that for the most part, especially offensively. As you said, I mean, they were just crushing the Athletics pitching staff. But this is not a balanced Major League Baseball team right now. They don't pitch and they don't field the ball well. So the Jays took advantage. So I'll say 75-25. What about you?
Yeah, I'm like 65-35. We're basically splitting hairs here. Like, the Blue Jays did play well. You know, they hit 11 homers in the series, and it's not like they were just throwing cookie after cookie after cookie. Like, I think we still saw pretty good quality of plate appearance from a lot of Blue Jays hitters, and I think that we saw aggressiveness when it called for it in terms of attacking on the first or second pitch of a plate appearance. And then I also think that we saw patience when it called for it, and I think we saw some more deliberate approaches being worked than I'm just going to take my ace swing on the first pitch that I see. A 455 OBP in the series, I think, speaks to that.
Springer hits another one to deep center. His second home run of the game. Both times on the first pitch of the at-bat.
You know, the Blue Jays were taking their walks as well. They were moving runners. They're doing things on the base paths, etc. But, you know, the Blue Jays didn't exactly pitch that well in the series either. They gave up 18 runs in the series, 7 on Friday and 7 on Saturday. And we've seen a lot of games this year when the Blue Jays offense wasn't clicking to the degree that we saw on the weekend, where giving up 7 runs was game over sometimes in the 5th or 6th inning. So I don't think that it was entirely due to the quality of the Blue Jays play, but certainly it wasn't, you know, slanted in favor of the quality of opposition. I think the Blue Jays played really well against a really poor opponent. And this is what good teams do. Like, you don't worry about what color the other team's uniforms are or what city they are or are not representing or what their record is coming in. You just, if you get a soft spot in the schedule, you win the games and you move on and you say, thank you very much. And you keep going. Like, if the Blue Jays had gone 3-1 in that series, that's almost like splitting it, really.
Right.
That's like, that would have been just like a okay series. And that's only one less win than they actually got. So to sweep the series, honestly, was something the Blue Jays should have done and they did it. And now they have to maintain, sustain their level of play against a higher quality of competition.
Right. Everyone gets to play the A's. Everyone gets to play the White Sox and the Marlins and the Rockies. And you don't get that many chances to play those teams if you play in the American League East, because that's just how the schedule works. And there are no total layups, at least for now, in the American League.
You get a lot of chances to play the Baltimore Orioles.
Well, and hey, if they sell, then those might become layups, and that could be a good thing. But for now, I'm not saying that's a layup. So you need to go out and take care of business. And the Jays are going to have a couple more chances to do that before the All-Star break, because they'll play the White Sox twice. Their only chances against the White Sox come up before the All-Star break. They will also play the Athletics in Sacramento with both co-hosts of this podcast on the scene to cover three more games against the Athletics. And they'll also play the Angels before the All-Star break. So this is kind of a relatively soft spot in the schedule when you look at certainly early July and late June. It's a little tougher before then, but the Jays have to take advantage. And so I'll give them full credit for that weekend. You sweep a team, you win four in a row, like a four-game sweep. That is really tough to do. That's rare. Probably the only four-game sweep that the Blue Jays will have this year, and that's fine. But they took care of business, and I'll give them a lot of credit for hitting the way that they did this past weekend.
Yeah, you're getting AAA coverage in a AAA ballpark going into the All-Star break.
That's major league coverage. That is major league coverage. I'm planning to bring my A game, file some of my best stories of the year from Sacramento. So speak for yourself there.
No, we're on the 26th. It's all that matters. We're in the show. We're collecting our per diem. We're collecting our check. We're on the buses. We're on the charter. Look, what's most important to me is that the Blue Jays don't give these four wins back immediately. The Blue Jays have now won five in a row. They are three games above 500. It's Tuesday morning. They're about to begin a series with the Phillies, and then they're going to go to Minneapolis on the weekend to play the Twins, two good teams, two winning teams. Take two or three from the Phillies at home, and then go to Minnie and take two or three from the Twins and go 4-2 over the next six. Now you're five games over 500. Now you're building. Now you're pushing up the standings. Like, now you are actually making something of the season and getting yourself to a point where you are definite, no question buyers by the trade deadline. If you cough up two or three to the Phillies, and then you cough up two or three to the Twins, and you go 2-4 over the next six, well, now you're just back to spinning your wheels, as we've seen all throughout this season. Whenever the Blue Jays have strung together three or four wins, they have immediately coughed up three of their next four or four of their next five. That's why they have like hovered around that plus or minus two games of 500 band for essentially over a month now. Like, they're three games above 500 right now. The last time they were three games above 500, it would have been like the first week of the season.
They're 5-2 at one point.
Were they 12-9? Yeah. They're 5-2 and they were 12-9. So like that was April. we're in June now. It's time to start putting some space between the Blue Jays and the 500 mark. No more of this dipping back below, because eventually they have to make a push. Eventually they have to make a move. Otherwise they're going to go into the trade deadline a game or two above or at 500, or maybe a game or two below with like 25-30% playoff odds. And you're just not going to be able to justify the kind of buy this team needs to make at the trade deadline in order to truly be competitive through late summer and into fall.
Yeah. I mean, you never know how it's going to go. And if they can make that push now, that's amazing. Sometimes you can face a good opponent and sweep them like the Jays did against the Mariners in Seattle. So that's on the table. Obviously, that's best case scenario. But I actually think even if they sort of do lose this series to the Phillies, which is obviously a very good team, then I think that's okay. Even if they lose the series to the Phillies and the Twins, obviously that's not best case scenario. But because of the way they played the A's, they could lose two series in a row and still be above 500, which is not something we've been able to say for a while. And obviously, you don't want to squander everything that you've just worked for in the course of 1 week. So I agree with you that it's better, obviously, if they can gain ground. But to me, the part of the schedule that they really have to gain ground on is that chunk before the All-Star break that I mentioned, where they're playing White Sox, Angels, Athletics. In the meantime, I think if they play 500 baseball for a couple weeks, then they're going to be in an okay spot. And let's not forget, too, this is a team that has Dalton Varsho, Anthony Santander, Jimmy Garcia, Andrés Giménez, all on the injured list. Max Scherzer. So that's part of Major League Baseball. Like, look at the Dodgers injured list as well. Good teams have lots of players hurt. Yankees, it is part of the game. So this isn't an excuse, but it is to say that if you're able to play 500 against these good teams for the next couple of weeks, I think you're fine with that.
Yeah, the injury thing, the Blue Jays have been so fortunate health-wise over the last really like 2 to 3 seasons. This is almost to be expected. To have like two everyday players and two regular starters, I'm going to throw Manoah in there as well, on your injured list, like that's not crazy. That's not unexceptional. That so many teams deal with that. Every team deals with that through periods of every year. And, you know, throw in the eighth inning guy, Jimmy Garcia. It's two everyday regulars, two starters, and an eighth inning guy on the IL. That's really just not exceptional for a team in 2025 MLB.
It's not. And I'll just jump in here with the Dodgers pitchers, just the pitchers on the injured list. They have Luis Garcia, Tyler Glasnow, Brusdar Gratterol, Michael Grove, Edgardo Henriquez, Kyle Hurt, the aptly named Kyle Hurt, Michael Kopech, Evan Phillips, River Ryan, Roky Sasaki, Emmett Sheehan, Blake Snell, Gavin Stone, Blake Treinen, and Kirby Yates. That is only their pitchers, and that's the Dodgers. So, I mean, and that's the Dodgers. So everyone deals with injuries. It is not an excuse, but it is reality that the Blue Jays right now do not have a number five starter. So this is not the best version of the Blue Jays that they hope to present to you in the course of this season. This current edition with Varsho and Santander down, I mean, it's going to get interesting here for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and you know, Bowden Francis is supposed to be the number five starter, which makes sense. Two trips through and see ya, right? And then we're turning it over to the bullpen. Like, that's the design. The problem is right now he's the number four. And, you know, look, Jose Berríos looked much better his last time out, which is great. The velo was back and the stuff was back. And just, you know, he cleaned up some things with his delivery and being more directional to the plate with his shoulders. And he just looked like he felt better physically on the mound. So that's great. But, you know, over the three or four starts prior to that, particularly the one in Tampa, it looked like, you know, Bowden Francis was right there at number three with Jose Berríos. So we'll see how this progresses. But yeah, no, you're right. The Blue Jays don't have a fifth starter. They regularly throw in bullpen days. Those bullpen days have like gone great. Honestly, John Schneider has managed so well in those bullpen days, whether it's, you know, Paxton Schultz starting, or, you know, whether it's Braden Fisher starting, or whether it's like Eric Lauer for a trip and then Yariel Rodriguez for a trip. Like, the Blue Jays have constructed some really good pitching plans and then executed on them very well, and had various sort of off ramps and exits that Pete Walker and John Schneider could take throughout. And sometimes they've had to take them. And, you know, like when, you know, Braden Fisher is supposed to, you know, go two full innings, and he ends up getting kind of blown up in the first. And sometimes they haven't had to take those exits. So like, it's a kudos to them and the game planning and the way that they've deployed guys. But yeah, obviously it's not sustainable. Obviously the Blue Jays are going to need a bit more help starting wise. They've gotten the position player depth to come through. When you get guys like Addison Barger and Ernie Clement kind of having the series that they did against the A's, Ernie Clement goes 11 for 18 in that series with six extra base hits against the team that released him in spring training a couple of springs ago. But you're still not quite seeing the starting depth that I think the Blue Jays are going to need through, you know, what is always a long and dogged summer if they're going to stay competitive.
I think it's just, and this is why they separated Bowden Francis from that bullpen day number five spot, but it's just the toll that it takes on the bullpen, because at a certain point, you're going to need those relievers for an extra innings game, or, you know, this is a time that Jimmy Garcia is down. So that means Yariel Rodriguez is in really high leverage, which seems to suit him. He's doing that well, but it just pushes everyone else into a bit more of a prominent role. So you can't be really asking too much of those guys, especially on consecutive days. Now, at least there's a one-day breather in between, but the overall toll on the pitching staff is going to be felt the longer that they just don't have a number five starter. And this is where, you know, it does tie into the offense, because if you have a massive lead, then you can ask your starting pitcher to go more. And so if the Blue Jays can somehow find a way to build on the offensive performance that they had against the Athletics, then all right, you put up nine against the Phillies. I know it's a lot to ask, but hypothetically, if you do that, then guess what? Bowden Francis, this guy can throw 110 pitches. Like, physically, he can do it. So if you're up 9-3, let Bowden roll.
Strike three called. A fastball at the bottom of the zone. Two down.
Well, that is a terrific sign for Bowden Francis. He is hitting his spots now.
And then all of a sudden, you're not taking that toll on the Braden Fishers of the world, on the Chad Greens of the world. You keep them more effective and rested for when you have a little bit more leverage. Now, it's easy to say, score nine against the Phillies. We'll see if they can do it, but this is the kind of thing that would allow them to weather this period of time, this extended period of time, where they just haven't had any fifth starter.
No, I think you're bang on, because in the month of May, and it's funny to say, based on how it feels, if you're just watching this team and not like closely following the Fangraphs leaderboards. But in the month of May, the Blue Jays offense was the second best offense in baseball to the LA Dodgers. 7.5 wins above replacement offensively in May. The Dodgers had 7.9. The number three team had 6.1. So the Blue Jays cleared the number three team, the Arizona Diamondbacks and New York Yankees, tied for number three by a win and 0.4 offensively. So that's like, that's a huge month offensively, which we have not seen from this team in some time. But what it covered up for was that the Blue Jays were a bottom 10 team in pitching war in the month of May. So that it really papered over some like lackluster pitching in the month of May, some super, super spotty outings, and it allowed the Blue Jays to have a month when they go 16-12 and they have like a plus 25 run differential in the month. It's really all on their offense. They allowed 112 runs in April and 111 in May. Nothing changed. But in April, they scored 81 runs. And in May, they scored 136. So I think you're bang on by saying that the way forward to get through this period of pitching uncertainty is to continue averaging 9.75 runs per game. Unlikely, but, you know, maybe five, right? Like, that would be helpful. You know, fewer series where it's, oh, the Blue Jays scored three runs in three games. Fewer road trips where it's, we scored seven runs in six games. The Blue Jays just need to keep scoring. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Like, do you think that the Blue Jays being a top five offense or the Blue Jays being a bottom 10 pitching, like, which of those do you think is closer to the truth?
I think both are exaggerated, but both are directionally true. Like, if you go back and scroll through your At the Letters feed, which, thanks for subscribing, by the way, and listening. But if you scroll back to March and you listen to Arden and I, I'm pretty sure that we were saying, hey, there's some offensive depth to this team. And we definitely said this. The pitching depth is going to be a concern. We highlighted that from the get-go. This is before Scherzer was hurt, because you could see it and you knew organizationally that this was a question that they had, is, you know, what's Jake Bloss going to do? Okay, he's hurt too now. That has really shown itself to be a reality for this team. They have pitching depth questions that are very real. And I was saying going into the season, I actually thought this team could be pretty solid offensively because they had some position player depth, and that some of the group of a Will Wagner, Alan Roden, Addison Barger could come up and do something. And now what we're seeing is Addison Barger is actually looking like the real deal.
And he's hit hard to deep right, and it is gone! What a series for Addison Barger. His third home run in as many games.
He's looking like an everyday major league player. He's got the tools for it. We've always known that. And now those tools are translating in a big way. So in this kind of roundabout way, Addison Barger, in a way, could help mitigate the questions on the pitching side. And he can do that by hitting dingers the way he did three games in a row against the Athletics. And if you're doing that, it just buys everyone a little bit of breathing room. So at a time that Santander and Varsho are both injured, it's going to be time for guys like Lucas and Barger and Ernie Clement to continue stepping up. They all had monster months of May, along with Alejandro Kirk and Bo Bichette and Vladdy. And they are going to need some of that group to really continue this, because this offensive depth is now getting tested too.
Yeah, one of the things I feel like I said ad nauseum coming into the season was that, like, the dirty little secret about the Blue Jays was that their pitching projected to be bottom five in baseball coming into the year. And everyone just kind of assumed that because the Blue Jays had pitched so well for 24 and 23 and 22 and 21 and on, that the Blue Jays were just going to be a sound pitching team again, and that the biggest concerns were with the offense. But, you know, I remember saying it here. I remember saying it on Bunkus's show. I remember saying it everywhere that we prattle on. Like, the Blue Jays were projected like 28th for starters and something like 26th or 25th for relievers coming into the season. So I was highlighting that as a concern, but it's not that I'm always right. I thought Will Wagner was going to have a solid year. You know, I thought his projections, like, you look at Zips and Steamer and anywhere, and it was like 115 OPS plus, 120 WRC plus. And I was like, all right, like, those are super strong projections. Even if he misses them by 10%, this is still going to be a really sound player that you're going to want in your lineup. didn't end up working out. That's where it's really big that you have, you know, to your point, like an Ernie Clement stepping up and obviously Barger and, you know, even a Jonathan Class A showing up and being useful in really specific circumstances, a Nathan Lucas being, and I've been banging on about Nathan Lucas for years, but like he's been even better than I think anyone expected that he would be.
Lucas with a high fly, deep right field, and long gone. And he just keeps getting big hits for the Blue Jays. That's his fourth home run of the season.
Because the Blue Jays are deploying him really optimally. And, you know, it may look on paper like the Blue Jays have this lineup crunch with, you know, with Andrés Giménez coming off of the IL here on Tuesday, it's assumed, and that, you know, they might not have enough playing time for all of these guys. I do think they have enough playing time for all of them because they're going to continue running platoons and they're going to continue deploying guys optimally. Like Nathan Lucas is performing as well as he has because of the matchups he's been put into. Same goes for Ernie Clement, same goes for Addison Barger, same goes for Jonathan Class A. And, you know, it's also if you end up with a matchup one night against a starting pitcher for whatever reason due to reverse splits or, you know, a swing path thing against that, you know, the style of shape of pitch that that pitcher throws and you're banging your head against the wall and you're like, ah, you know, we can't have all of like Barger, Lucas and Clement in the lineup. Like one of these guys has to sit. Who's going to be? It's such a tough decision. Well, that's called depth and that's called a good thing. That's called like when you're making difficult decisions, this is where you want your roster to be.
And think about what you just said, too. Like, imagine if, you know, if we knew in March that you'd be saying, oh, man, how are we going to fit Barger, Lucas and Clement into the batting order? That is the definition of a good problem to have for all those guys to be hitting the way that they are. And yeah, it's not Joey Loperfido. It's not Will Wagner. Maybe it's a little bit of a different outcome than some people would have guessed. Jonathan Class A, I still think has, you know, some room to grow as he tries to show that he's a, you know, a dependable major league player. But man, that is a good problem to have with these guys contributing. And I absolutely think that there's room for them in the lineup, especially because Barger and Clement give you positional versatility.
Yeah, and I think your only true everyday players who are healthy right now are Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. You know, like, because look, Kirk's going to be 4 out of 6, with two of them being Heinemann / Sanchez. I mean, I don't think Barger is a no question, write him in every single matchup, every single day player. I think he's a 4 or 5 out of 6 guy, which is a lot, right? Like that's the second tier behind no question in the lineup every day, but I don't think he's an everyday player. George Springer's gonna get a day off here and there because he's 35. I think that even when Giménez comes back, he gets a day off every 4 games or 5 games or so, just to like not put too much on his quad too soon. And then yeah, you know, you got guys like Lucas and Clement and Class A, Roden now that he's back here, Miles Straw, who are all in pretty clear platoons. Davis Schneider fits into that as well, assuming that he's sticking around when Giménez comes back and Michael Stefanik is likely heading out.
You'd assume that?
I would assume that. Do you not?
I mean, rather keep Stefanik, but by the time people listen to this, they'll know, so I probably shouldn't spend too much time on this. But
shouldn't. To me, Stefanik and Clement would be kind of redundant on the roster, no?
Yeah, but if they're both good, then I'd take two good redundant players.
Fair, but I mean, I think Davis Schneider, my sense is he's not coming back just for one game. Like, my sense is he's coming back to get a little bit of a run here. Wow. We'll see. Clearly, the Blue Jays believe in him. And I think the power potential with Davis as well is there. And if one of Davis Schneider and Michael Stefanik is going to get on like a 2 or 3 week heater, it's probably going to be Davis Schneider.
I mean, I'm sort of intrigued by Stefanik, but the listeners already know this answer, so we don't need to.
I'm a Stefanik guy. I was the only person writing about him in spring.
I'm with you. I like Stefanik. So I'd be intrigued to see what he can do there. Just the bat to ball. I like the bat to ball.
I am a Stefanik guy. We'll see. Look, either way, whether it's Stefanik or Schneider, you've just got a bunch of guys who are in platoons towards the bottom. So I just don't see the lineup crunch. Like I see this as like very, very manageable on a day-to-day basis based on matchups, based on who's playing well, based on who's banged up, based on who needs a day, based on whose swing path that you like against, you know, somebody's stuff, and also based on who you want on your bench, depending on the typical deployment of your opposition's bullpen.
So Varsho came back, and he was pretty much himself for the month of May. tied for the team league in home runs, made some incredible catches. Obviously, we talked about the throwing arm that wasn't there, but let's say he was 90% of who he should be, which is a very, very good major league player, someone who had a 5-WAR season last year. Now, is it an insane hot take by me to say that the Blue Jays are actually in an okay position to backfill for him?
I'd much rather have Dalton Varsho than a platoon of Lucas Straw, which yes. I assume is going to be the backfill, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Give me Varsho and let me put my Lucas Straw platoon in left.
100% or put them on the bench. No question. You'd rather have Dalton Varsho. But I guess what I'm saying is, if you have Straw there for defensive purposes, he starts some games against lefties, he comes in late for defense, then offensively, Nathan Lucas is kind of cooking right now. You have Barger, he's doing well. You want him to be in there. If Jimenez is back, maybe we're playing Clement more at third. Maybe Barger goes to right field. Springer can DH. Like, I think, put it this way, I feel more confident in their ability to cover for Varsho now than I did going into the season when it was kind of an unknown what guys like Lucas and Straw would offer.
Yeah, and the thing is, against lefties, like, the Blue Jays have shown no willingness to play Nathan Lucas against lefties.
And he crushes righties, so clearly his role should be against righties.
Yeah, there's probably a good reason there. So then that means you have Miles Straw in. And Miles Straw definitely is contributing to this team in a big way. Like, quality to him, he's made the most of limited opportunities, and he doesn't play every day, and he's ready to do something positive and ready to contribute every time that he's in there. And you talk to him, and that's all he wants to do, is he just wants to contribute to winning. Like, he's not stat chasing. He's not trying to prove to somebody that he should be an everyday player. He's literally, every time that he's in the game, he's like, what do I need to do to help the team win? He's win. Like, the Blue Jays talk about that internally all the time. What's important now? Win. And that's been the message to the players since spring, and Miles Straw has bought in to that message. But he's still, the offensive results over the last several years kind of speak for themselves.
No doubt.
So that is still somewhat of an offensive black hole at the bottom of your lineup.
Right. There's a reason the Blue Jays are bunting so much. And it's not because John Schneider just, suddenly had a change of heart and doesn't like home runs anymore. Like, he likes dingers. Yeah. No, John Schneider knows what the stats say. But hey, if you have Ali Sanchez and Miles Straw and sometimes Nathan Lucas at the bottom of your batting order, you're going to ask those guys to bunt at times. Stefanik. I mean, yeah. And with a lot of variation in the kind of results you get, as anyone who watched Ali Sanchez try to bunt knows. But yeah, this is why they've been doing that at the bottom of the batting order. They don't really have the personnel sometimes, 1 through 13 on the position player side, to just mash. And that's why it was a refreshing contrast for the month of May to see this team really perform like one of the best offensive teams in baseball. And it is a little shocking given the way we talked about them in April, but give them credit. Give David Popkins credit. Give the hitters credit. This is a group that really did what they should be doing. And hey, if you have Bo Bichette hitting 7 home runs in a month, like, I'm not saying that's going to happen, at any point for the rest of the season, but seeing him regain that power stroke, that's a really good sign for this team.
Yeah, the coaches did a great job of deployment and a great job of sort of pushing buttons and pulling levers in game. Like, I think the Blue Jays coaching staff, honestly, has just had a tremendous year, and we don't probably talk about it enough. Whether it is like the behind the scenes stuff that you're referring to with David Popkins and Lou Iannotti, like getting Addison Barger right again, I'm sure they've done some stuff with Nathan Lucas that's helping him have more success. What they've gotten out of George Springer early in the season is great.
Yeah.
Then Pete Walker's work speaks for itself, with just what he's done with his pitching staff, not just this year but over years. And then John Schneider with filling out the lineup and deployment and lifting pitchers and who he brings in from the bullpen. There haven't been many nights where I've been disagreeing with his pitching decisions. So I just think the coaching staff has had a very strong year. That said, look, in May, everybody was hitting. The Blue Jays had 10 players in May who had a WRC plus of 100 or above.
And I think 7 of those guys had like a WRC plus of 134 or above. Like, it was, they had some guys who were just mashing.
9 of those guys are 127 above.
Wow.
So I don't know that that's going to be the case going forward. I don't know that Jonathan Class A is going to have a 129 going forward, or Jimenez before he got hurt was a 127. Even like Tyler Heineman at 97 is playing above his head, you know? So Nathan Lucas at 148. Like I just, you know, when some of that down lineup production comes back to earth, and when you're looking at a bottom four of your batting order, that's like Lucas, Class A, Roden, Heineman, or whatever sort of configuration of that is on a Sunday, that's when some of this could get questionable.
Have you ever voted for Manager of the Year?
I did once when I was like really young in the BBWAA, and I have since like told Shai I just do not, I just won't, because I can't evaluate it. I don't watch all 15 managers, no. Right? Like closely. I just can't evaluate it. There's no data.
Yeah. I've never voted for Manager of the Year. It would be such a tough one. Like, you know, I put a lot of thought into MVP ballots or Cy Young ballots whenever I do that. And those are tough in their own way, but they're tough in a way that like, hey, if I really look at this, I can come up with an answer I feel good about, but I cannot imagine voting for Manager of the Year. And this is where it's like, you look at May. Yeah. Of course, these players made the coaching staff look amazing. Like, they made David Popkins look great. And I actually believe that David Popkins is probably better suited to this role than Don Mattingly. And that's, you know, obviously the Blue Jays made that shift. And Don Mattingly is still such an important part of this coaching staff in a different way, where he can really help John Schneider in different ways. But, you know, assessing this stuff, it's so tricky. And that's for the team that we literally, like, talk to these coaches and know the coaches and talk to the manager every day. Imagine trying to do that for like the, you know, the LA Angels. Like it's just, there's so much that goes into it, but it's a bit of a black box.
Yeah. I know like pretty intimately how hard the coaches in Toronto work and like how passionate they are, how much they care, what their communication's like with players, etc. I don't know that for 14 other teams. And so much of what coaches and managers do is untelevised and unbroadcast. It's like the 20 hours of a day that they aren't in a game or in a, you know, pregame warmup or a postgame press conference or whatever. Like, so I just have no way of evaluating the quality of a manager's job performance anywhere, really.
Yeah, for Toronto, I think we can evaluate whether, you know, things are going well. How precise that evaluation is, I don't know. But I think that we can have, you know, some semblance of an idea, I should hope, given how much time we spend covering this team. And I do think that this coaching staff is off to a good start. I think it's going well so far.
Yeah, I just don't know what Rocco Baldelli or Matt Quatraro, you know, does behind closed doors. I don't even know, like, their pitching decisions, right? Like, I don't know about their bunt and hit and run decisions. Like, I don't watch every Kansas City Royals game closely. At least when it comes to evaluating players, I have the cold, hard, empirical data that I can use. And then I can, like, cross-reference that with asking, you know, players on the Jays and players I know on other teams, hey, what do you think of, you know, Rookie of the Year this year? Like, hey, what do you think of this guy versus that guy? And I can arrive at a pretty good idea. I think even like players on the Blue Jays wouldn't really have that good of a sense of like just, you know, how effective Bruce Bochy is at managing the Rangers or not.
No. If you're looking for someone to crush Alex Cora and Andrew Bailey for the way that they're managing the Red Sox, you found the wrong podcast. This is not it.
All right. We'll step away, but when we come back, we should hammer away at some more granular developments when it comes to the Toronto Blue Jays, all that and so much more, and we continue on At the Letters. It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Bennickson Smith, our producer is Christian Ryan. Thanks so much for listening. Ben, it's kind of interesting that we just went through an entire first half of the podcast talking about how strong the offense has been, and the name Vladimir Guerrero Jr. didn't come up once. He's the second highest paid player in the game. He's signed a $500 million contract this year. He's currently riding a career best 32 game on base streak. So the last time the guy played a game and didn't get on base was like April. And yet, offensive war in the month of May, you got names like Ernie Clement and Addison Barger and Alejandro Kirk above him. So is this Vladimir Guerrero Jr. that we've seen to this point? Is there like a torrid hot streak to come with him? Are the Blue Jays getting enough from him? Are they getting so many depth contributions that's kind of papering over a weird year for Vlad? Like where do you stand on him right now?
I think he's having a really good, productive season that has not gone into great transcendent mode yet. And I still think that he's probably got a month or two where he goes into that transcendent mode and just goes off. And look, this isn't the only player around the game who's been very, very good as opposed to amazing so far. Bobby Witt Jr. would be another one, the runner-up for the MVP last year in the American League. He's been very, very good, hasn't really hit for power so far. Do I believe in Bobby Witt Jr.? Of course. And I believe in Vladimir Guerrero Jr. But the amazing thing is, and this is why I was in favor of extending him, even at the very, very high price tag that it ended up being, you look at Vladdy, third of the way through the season, he's got 1.5 F4, 1.7 B war. That puts him on pace for give or take a 4.5 or 5 war season. And that's before he's even gone off. So this is where I just think he's an elite player to the point that even when he's not connecting for a home run binge and he's not necessarily putting it into the seats every second day, he is still such a good offensive player and quietly has been one of the essential players for this team in the course of their last month.
Yeah, I think that there is a very torrid Vladdy stretch coming. And I don't know if it's going to be in the next 2 weeks. I don't know if it's going to be late June. I don't know if it doesn't start until Canada Day, but it's coming. For all the reasons you just cited, I won't repeat them. The one thing that I would add to that is that mentally, he's in a great place. And when he talks about his approach behind the scenes, he's saying all the right things. Like he is, I think at times in recent years, when he's gone through stretches where he's not seeing the results that he's capable of and the ball isn't leaving the yard, we see him expand and we see him get too big at the plate. You know, he'll get out of his swing and he'll just swing at pitches that like leave you shaking your head almost of like, yeah, how is this guy swinging at that pitch? We're not seeing that happen right now. Like he's got an 85th percentile chase rate in baseball right now. He's got the lowest chase rate of his career this year. It's like 6 points lower than it was last season. And B, just from like talking to him, I hear him talking about process and approach and what he can and cannot control more than I've heard him talk about those things in the past. I don't think he's feeling that weight anymore to like carry the offense or to be the hero, to win the game, like to be the guy. He's talking about, if I hit a ball really hard to right center and it goes right at a defender, that's fine. Like I am fine making that out. I would much rather make that out than make the out where I'm, you know, hitting the ground ball to short or like hitting it, you know, popping it up on the infield. As long as he's hitting a line drive sort of straight up the middle opposite way at a high rate of speed, he's happy. Cause he, you know, and he said this to me, like, the only thing I can control is hitting the ball hard and the shape of the contact I'm making. Whatever happens after it leaves my bat is up to the baseball gods. Like that is just out of my control. But I know that if I am like hitting those, you know, having that shape of contact in that direction at that rate of speed, the good things are going to come. And like, it's, you know, it's the eternal Vladdy thing where it's, he's atop the league in all these hard hit metrics. He's got the fourth most hard hit balls in baseball this year. I mean, the barrel rate's going to be up there. The average exit velo is like 93 plus miles per hour. I mean, you know, there's only like 10 or 15 guys who are even, you know, in his territory in terms of how hard he hits the ball. And those other guys are like Shohei Ohtani and Aaron Judge and Pete Alonso and Bobby Witt Jr. and Manny Machado and Rafael Devers. Like, it's the kind of company you want to be keeping. So I think that the results are going to come for it.
Guerrero high in the air to deep left field, and that one is gone. Number 8 on the season for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And
this is, I agree. And just to look at the projections, I brought them up here on FanGraphs for the rest of the season. This is using Oopsie, and the only players who project to be better than Vladdy from this point on, Aaron Judge, Shohei Ohtani, Yordan Alvarez, who's hurt, and Juan Soto. So Judge, Ohtani, Soto. Those are the only players that would project to be better. I believe when you look at those numbers, when you watch Vladdy's ABs, you hear what you just said about his approach and mentality, you watch the kind of I don't want to say celebrations, but like he's enjoying the walks that he's drawing. It's a little bit more Soto-esque this year, where he'll flip his bat, he'll sprint off to first base. You can tell he's feeling the benefit of drawing a walk, which obviously is a very good thing for his team. So I think for all those reasons, we're talking about an elite hitter. So far, as I said, the results have been more very good, but I think that they're going to trend up and they're already in a good spot. So it's not like he's having a bad year. He's having a very good year. And I think there's room for even more.
Yeah. And I like how that bothers people too, when he like bat flips a walk or when he isn't, you know, eternally disappointed that he hit like a 115 mile per hour out or something like that. And people go, oh, way to go. Like way to go. Another hard hit out. Like, what is that doing for us? Exit velocity. I don't know who needs to hear this, but balls hit 95 plus this year. So a 95 mile per hour plus exit velo this year have a 1379 OPS, and balls hit 90 to 94 exit velo this year have a 495 OPS. So we're talking about an 884 point difference between the balls hit 90 to 94 and the balls hit 95 plus. Yes, the balls hit 95 plus are not always going to be hits. Welcome to baseball. The majority of this game is people making outs. Like that, I don't think there has ever been a team that ran above a 500 OBP.
No, so there has no not. We can say that if, for sure. Barely been a player who did that. I think Ted Williams is the only one with an OBP, or maybe Barry Bonds.
Yeah, if you're watching the 27 Yankees, you're watching outs happen considerably more often than you're watching not.
Even Ted Williams, OBP lifetime 482.
Yeah, like balls hit 95 plus, the batting average is 474 with a 469 OBP. So yeah, outs still happen more often than not on balls hit 95 plus. But balls hit 90 to 94 have a 223 batting average and a 219 OBP. Like, that's the difference. Hit the ball hard consistently. Exit velocity matters. It correlates incredibly strongly as anything we have access to strong offensive production. That's why atop the hard hit rate leaderboards and exit velo leaderboards and barrel rate leaderboards, it's Judge, Cruz, Otani, Devers, Addison Barger, Alonso, Gunnar Henderson, Juan Soto, like... That's why these guys are up there, because hitting the ball hard matters and exit velo matters. You know, you heard it the first like 2, 3, 4 weeks of Addison Barger's big league tenure this year, where he was hitting everything hard and he just kept making outs. And, you know, we were coming on and saying, man, like this guy squares up a lot of balls and he's not chasing a ton and his approach is really good. Like this ought to turn for him. And there was a lot of commentary saying, well, you know, is he ever going to, are the results ever going to come? It's a results business. Like we don't just want hard hit outs. And now everyone wonders why he's like hitting a home run every day, because these things change. These things turn. Same thing like John Schneider said all year when the Blue Jays were going through these weird periods where they weren't scoring with runners in scoring position and they're leaving runners on base and they're hitting everything hard right at guys. They'd have like the 10 of the 15 hardest hit balls in the game and they'd lose. And he said, it's going to turn. It comes around. You just have to trust that variance is variance in baseball. Randomness is randomness. And eventually the results will even out. And I think you're seeing that with Barger. You're seeing that with the Blue Jays in general. And I think that you're going to see Vladdy get really, really hot over the second half of this year.
It's funny with the runners in scoring position, because at least my impression of this, I wonder what yours is, but at least my impression is it's only ever a storyline when it goes badly. And we never talk about it when it's going well. And for example, the Blue Jays in their most recent win were 5-for-10. With runners in scoring position, you know, and you go to the previous day, they were 1-for-3 with runners in scoring position. So a lot of the time, I think that the focus goes there only when it's bad.
The Blue Jays hit 447 with runners in scoring position against the A's.
Wow.
In that four game series.
Yeah.
447.
Yeah.
And we didn't mention it once. Didn't mention runners in scoring
position. To be fair, let's be consistent. It's going to regress. They're not going to do that well going forward, because no one does.
No, they will not. But I think that over the course of the season, like their batting average with runners in scoring position will generally trend towards what their batting average at all times is, because the skill is hitting. The skill isn't hitting with runners in scoring position.
Right. And it's probably slightly lower because in those situations, managers go to their better relievers. So you're facing tougher competition. So if you're a 260 true talent team, you probably hit 255 with runners in scoring position.
Right. But if you see a huge discrepancy, if that 260 true talent team is hitting like 210, or if it's hitting 310, you can feel pretty confident that over 162, the 310 is going to regress down and the 210 is going to regress up.
Absolutely.
Positively. Any other big concerns with the Blue Jays right now, Ben? I guess we got to mention Jeff Hoffman, don't we?
Yeah.
Because it kind of keeps coming up where runs are being allowed in big spots.
For most of the season, when I've watched Jeff Hoffman, my confidence level has been extremely high with him just because I love the velocity. I love the track record. The splitter, you know, for most of the season looked really good. The slider, you're talking about three really good pitches and someone with experience. And I just liked everything that I've seen. Now, recently, I'll admit that's wavered a little bit. And there was, a game this weekend. I want to say it was the Saturday game where, Jeff Hoffman allowed the home run to Brent Rooker. That was on a pitch over the heart of the plate. He also had a walk on base for that one, which is not good. And it was the very final out of the game that Ernie Clement made a very nice stop to catch a line drive that could have scored the tying run. So watching that one, I didn't like what I saw from Jeff Hoffman in that game. So I'll admit to feeling a little bit of doubt around Jeff Hoffman now in a way that I just fully did not for the first 6-7 weeks of the season. But at the same time, relievers are allowed to have bad games too. And relievers are allowed to miss location and make bad pitches too. And I think that Jeff Hoffman is still going to be a very, very good pitcher. I just think he's dealing with a lapse in command right now that his track record, his extended track record over the course of, let's say, 3 seasons, suggests he will find the strike zone, he will find the command, and the results will improve. But I would say my confidence level is now an 8 out of 10 as opposed to a 10 out of 10.
Yes, I agree that it is a command issue, an execution issue, and a little bit of a stuff issue.
Yes.
The fastball has been exceptional this year. Like, I think that Jeff Hoffman has a tremendous fastball. Stuff plus other pitch models will tell you it's been a lot better than it's been at any point in his career. Those pitch models will also tell you that his splitter has not been as good as it was.
And the eye test confirms that. It floats to the right. It doesn't dive down the way you would want it to.
Yes. And so I think that for whatever reason, his splitter isn't where it needs to be. And we see pitchers go through this. We've seen Bowden Francis's splitter be really inconsistent. We've seen Kevin Gausman battling his splitter throughout this year. Blue Jays feel like they finally got him back on track with it when they showed him some footage that they gathered with Edgetronic cameras that just like slowed down his point of release in really high definition and showed that the splitter actually wasn't coming off of his fingers the way that he intends it to. He just wasn't feeling that he didn't have the right grip. So they feel like they've kind of gotten to the bottom of that issue. And you'll see Kevin Gausman take an extra beat on the mound between pitches to really make sure that he has his grip dialed in and he's executing that pitch the way he needs to while minding the running game and trying not to, pitch tip and managing the pitch clock and all these other things that pitchers have to worry about. He just kind of lost the feel for his grip a bit. So there's various things that could be happening with Hoffman's splitter. All I know is that the results aren't there, the shape isn't there, the effectiveness isn't there. He probably should throw it a bit less often. I've seen some, 3-2 counts against like the 9 hitter where he's going to secondary stuff when I feel like he should just like trust his fastball more. I think that there's been some pitch selection issues, which could be him, could be his catcher, who knows. Where whether he's operating with like a 3-run lead and just needs to lean on his fastball and let hitters get themselves out, or whether, the splitter isn't there, he's not landing the slider for strikes. Like, I just think throw his fastball a bit more for now until he figures out his secondary stuff.
And there have been times that this is going back a while, but he walked Kyron Paris, in a leadoff situation with too much spin in that at bat. And it's sort of like, are we really doing this when you probably do want to challenge? Well, I'm not going to go super, super granular beyond that. I agree with you. If the fastball is playing up and the splitter's not, probably want to use that fastball a little bit. But again, Relievers work through this stuff. Pitchers work through this stuff. If you look at Devin Williams of the Yankees, he lost his closer's job. Then the last 2-3 weeks, he's been dominant again. And this can happen in the course of a season with any pitcher. When a reliever loses it and they get hammered, it's going to look a little more exaggerated and the numbers aren't going to look good. And realistically, Jeff Hoffman's not going to have a nice ERA this year. Like, it's not going to look good because he's been hit so hard. And some of those pitches, like the Caminero home run or the Drake Baldwin home run off of him, you look at the pitch location on this, it's like not a lot of hitters are hitting that pitch that Caminero hit. It was not a good pitch. It was a ball, but like, I'm not going to hammer Jeff Hoffman for that. So I think he's going to be okay, but I will acknowledge that some doubt has crept in because of that splitter and because he's walking too many guys.
Well, an ERA is also like the worst way to evaluate a reliever. Like,
it's down there.
I just don't pay attention to ERA when it comes to relievers because it's just, you know, all of baseball is small samples and relievers are the small sample of small samples. So like you said, his ERA last year was 2.17. He's not going to be even close to that this year. He could be perfect the rest of the way and he's still going to be in the threes just because of the results that have happened right now and because he's not going to have the opportunities to unwind that from an ERA basis. But we have better ways of evaluating pitchers. His expected ERA based on the quality of contact that he's allowed is 2.86. So we're talking about like half of what his actual ERA is. I think to me, you know, one of the most valuable metrics that we have for evaluating relievers is strikeout minus walk rate, because we know strikeout and walk rate to be predictive over enough time. Yeah. And we know that those actually kind of establish themselves as reliable fairly quickly in the season. Jeff Hoffman among MLB relievers has the 10th best strikeout minus walk rate at 29%. Right. He has a 35.5% strikeout rate and a 6.5% walk rate. Those are exceptional numbers. Those are great numbers. He has a better strikeout minus walk rate right now than Edwin Diaz. It's better than, you know, Hunter Gattis, who has a 1.14 ERA. It's better than Chris Martin, who has a 1.83 ERA. It's better than Tyler Rogers, who's a 1.7, and Andres Munoz, who's a 1.4. Like, I just think that 29% strikeout minus walk rate tells you that, like, Jeff Hoffman is still very effective and his stuff in certain cases is still like really overpowering and really good. I just think the fact that he's throwing his fastball less this year than he did last year, and he's throwing twice as many splitters this year as he did last year, probably want to change that a little bit. I would say a few less splitters until you get it sorted out and a few more fastballs because that pitch has been dominant.
Yep. I think that makes a lot of sense. And you look at Jeff Hoffman, even if he is a two-pitch pitcher, like Jordan Romano, who's coming into town, he kind of switched spots with Hoffman this offseason, and he's a two-pitch pitcher. He's had a lot of success like that in his career with fastball slider. So the third pitch for a closer is almost like a bonus, really. It's not something that you assume. Mariano Rivera had one pitch his entire career. So two is usually the baseline for a dominant closer. The third pitch for a lot of closers is kind of a show-me pitch. And for Hoffman, it's real. But he can get results, even if it is fastball slider for a while. He's going to be good. But to build off your point on the K minus BB, the Blue Jays actually as a team are among the league leaders there, and their bullpen is the best in baseball when it comes to strikeout rate minus walk rate. So they've been very good at controlling the zone. Conversely, though, and this is kind of the counterbalance to that, they have had so many home run issues. So yeah, they're doing a really good job of getting the strikeouts, avoiding the walks. But the third part of that is where they need to show more growth. Bowden Francis, obviously a part of that on the starting pitching side. Chad Green, too many bombs on the relief side. Hoffman, too many bombs on the relief side. So that's kind of the story of the Blue Jays pitching staff. They've actually controlled the zone well, but they're giving up way too many dingers.
Yep, there's no disagreeing with that. Absolutely. I think, you know, the Hoffman thing, it reminds me a little bit of Yariel Rodriguez. And, you know, why has Yariel Rodriguez been so effective over the last month? Like in the month of May, he was like one of the Blue Jays' best relievers, if not the best. Why is that? Well, because he cut his fastball percentage by 10% and upped his slider percentage by 10%. And why did he do that? Because his fastball has a 95 stuff plus and his slider has a 110 stuff plus. So how about you throw the better pitch more often? And now all of a sudden, the results are better. Eventually, hitters are going to adjust and they're going to figure out what you're doing. And Yariel Rodriguez is going to have to adjust again. But just by like making those adjustments to throw in fewer fastballs and throw in more sliders, he's had a lot more success. It's not necessarily complicated. I think it's hard for a lot of pitchers to throw their fastball less because like it's always been their most thrown pitch. Like, talk to Braden Fisher about that. He throws way more sliders now than he does fastballs. But, you know, throughout his time with the Dodgers, they were like, hey, man, your slider's really good. You should probably throw this more often. And Fisher was like, yeah, but like what got me drafted as a prep player out of Texas was the fact that I threw like 97 at 17. It was my fastball. And I know that this organization, the Dodgers, really prioritizes stuff and really values like big, hard fastballs. So, man, like, I don't know. Like, I kind of want to keep throwing this fastball. I think that's what's going to get me to the majors. He gets traded for Kevin Biggio. He shows up at the Blue Jays. They give him the pitch recs, their, you know, recommendations for what you should throw when you're ahead, when you're behind, when it's two strikes, when it's a righty and you're in a two strike count, whatever. And it was slider, 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 like every single one of his pitch recs. And a light bulb went off and he was like, huh, I guess that, you know, what the Dodgers were saying and what the Jays were saying, like two smart, savvy organizations, I guess there's something to that. I guess I'll start throwing my slider more often. Now Braden Fisher throws his slider more than anything, and he's in the big leagues. And he was having a lot of success until he opened that game and didn't. But we're seeing this similar thing with Yariel Rodriguez, where, you know, you just kind of tweak the usage a little bit, and all of a sudden a bullpen arm can start looking a lot better than they were prior. So I think that for Hoffman, yeah, it's probably just a little bit of an adjustment, and you're going to see him being really, really good.
Yeah. And really nice start to Braden Fisher's career. That actually looks like a pretty nice trade to get Braden Fisher for Kevin Biggio.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a nice pickup.
Where's Kevin Biggio right now?
Kansas City Royals.
Right? I mean, is he like in the majors with them?
He has been. I'll bring up his page right here. Kevin Biggio this year has a 174 batting average, a 543 OPS. He has 11 walks and one home run and negative 0.2 war with the Royals. But rooting for Kevin Biggio. ATL is a pro Kevin Biggio podcast, so hopefully he can get that on track.
I am never not rooting for Kevin Biggio. He was great when he was here. Great from our perspective. Great to talk to. Lots of insight. Never not rooting for him. But yeah, I think, you know, that's a pretty good trade from the Blue Jays perspective.
It is. Now, do you want to talk about the number five spot and Scherzer and Turnbull and what the Jays are kind of trying to juggle and get moving in that fifth rotation spot here?
What's on your mind there?
Well, you know, I just think we've talked about Scherzer so much, right? Hall of Famer, someone who's been so essential to this team. He's throwing live sim games now, facing hitters. Meanwhile, Spencer Turnbull in the minor leagues in AAA. Which one of these guys do you think is closer to coming back?
Well, Spencer Turnbull, literally, because when he signed, there was like a 35-day provision in his contract on which he could be optionally assigned. And I don't know exactly where we stand with that right now, but I the other day I was looking at it with Shy, and I think he has one more start, like room for one more start essentially before he has to be brought up to the majors. And the issue with that is that his velocity has been down a whole bunch in the minors. It's that he didn't make it out of the second inning, in his last start at Buffalo. Just talking to people with the Blue Jays, they don't believe it's a physical issue for the reason why his velocity is down, and they're currently working with him on some mechanical stuff to try to get the velo back. Some of it could just be because he's going through like a spring training buildup right now, and you know, there's always a little bit of a dead arm period in there. And also, you know, this is a big league pitcher who's pitching in the minors, so there's like a little less intensity there and a little less adrenaline. Eric Swanson talked about that when he came back this week and said, he hopes to have an extra tick in the majors, just getting into those environments. But I think the velo is concerning, but he is the closest because Max Scherzer ain't going to be back within 10 to 12 days. He could get out on a rehab assignment in those 10 to 12 days, but I think he's probably going to need like at least two rehab outings before he's back.
I would think so. And I guess the answer is that there are still questions with both, really. And, you know, that's kind of the nature of the number five spot of most rotations. I mean, even on the very best teams in the league, we just ran through the Dodgers injured list. Yankees have questions at the back of their rotation. So do the Padres. So do the Tigers. Blue Jays are not alone in this, but sure would have been nice if Spencer Turnbull had shown up and kind of been sitting 94 and getting through maybe four innings at a time in his rehab starts. Not the case right now. So Scherzer as well, obviously we all, you know, have followed this with his thumb for 2 months now. more than 2 months, because really it started in spring training. And so he has said consistently throughout this process that really it's going to be how his thumb responds after he's throwing, after he's really pushing his thumb in a game or game-like setting. So there are still unknowns there for Scherzer and for Turnbull. And so I guess this points us in the direction of continued uncertainty for that number five spot.
Yeah, with Turnbull, I'll be very curious to see what Vila looks like the next time out. I agree with you. It would have been nice if his arm was a bit more prepared, I guess, when he got to the Blue Jays. It's not like he was, one or two innings in his first outing with with Dunedin. He was four innings, right? So, he threw 54 pitches there. And he's been up to 73. So, he should be at a place where the Blue Jays are, comfortable asking him to throw like 85 to 90 pitches. So you would expect that there would be more velo there. It doesn't have to be the top end of what we've seen from him, but what we are seeing right now, I think, is in the concerning category. In Dunedin, there was also a comebacker to the mound that was very much his play to make, and a play wasn't made there. So there's just been a lot of kind of strangeness with his buildup, but push is coming to shove with him.
And I think if it comes to a point where they have to roster him based on the terms of his contract, then you could certainly do that and put him in a low leverage relief role. But if he's sitting 90-91 with the fastball, I don't think you can hand him the starting rotation spot. I don't think you can do that.
No. And similarly, with Max Scherzer, like when he gets into games or when he gets past that 50 pitch threshold, that's going to be big. Cause by his own admission, it happens, like the thumb issues and the nerve issues happen when he gets past 50 pitches. So he hasn't done that yet in a bullpen or in a live, and I'm going to be very curious to see what happens, because if the thumb issues come back, if the nerve issues come back, I think this is like Max Scherzer's last shot at this buildup right here. He's not going back to square one and starting from scratch again.
Not doing two more cortisone shots and more visits to Dr. Keith Meister. No. It's like, no, I think it's a different doctor. But anyways.
To me, this is the last attempt. And it's either going to be successful or it's not. So there's actually a lot riding on it. So I'm going to be very, very curious to see how that plays out and just how he's feeling physically after some of his more extended outings. It's Tuesday. So the schedule was here today on Tuesday. He was supposed to throw a two-up bullpen, maybe, 40, 45 pitches. So we'll see how he feels after that, assuming that happens at Rogers Center, that live BP. It's not like we're not going through this again. This is the last one for Scherzer. So if he does have a setback or he doesn't feel right, going to be really curious to see what the decision-making looks like there, because I don't know that there's a lot of willingness on his part to go into a bullpen role.
Well, that's a possibility that you would have to explore, though, right? I mean, I think that common sense would say if you can't throw more than 50 pitches, but you can throw 35 or 40, we'll take the 35 or 40 from the future Hall of Famer. And look, it might not be his favorite option, but he's getting $15.5 million. So there's got to be a willingness to have that discussion. And I think there would be. But, we're not there yet, so no need to get too far ahead of things. But best case scenario, that thumb feels great. And we're talking about, a healthy Max Scherzer, because that would be fun to watch.
He would have to be bought into that, and he has not pitched out of the bullpen in the regular season since his rookie year in 2008.
Yep, it's been a while. It's been a while, but you know what? If that's what he can offer and if that's what the Blue Jays need, I think that has to be on the table. We're not there now, but I don't think it's an unreasonable ask. Let's put it that way.
In the meantime, if you're the Blue Jays, you're like, hey, Adam Macko, keep getting healthy. Hey, Adam Klofenstein, like, keep getting healthy, keep making progress, because they're an injury away from being in a real bad place when it comes to their starting pitching depth. And for all the good pitching stories in the organization this year, whether you want to talk about Treya Savage or, Cal Steven, they're all pretty far away. You've got guys like Landon Marudas and Brandon Barriera coming back from TJ right now. And Ricky Tiedemann is throwing, and, apparently Barriera looks great. And, Marudas is, making really positive steps, but these guys, none of these guys are getting to the bigs this year. Like Treya Savage is not going to be in the majors this year. I think he'll be at AA over the second half of the season. And I think Cal Steven will trail, somewhere behind him and be at AA maybe in the final month or two. But those guys are not going to be in the majors this year.
And so this is where, and these are great stories. These are great, you know, young promising players, Arjun Namala as well. You know, there's reason to be excited about this group, and that's awesome. But there still is a hole in this farm system when it comes to major league ready starting pitching. And so you need Berríos, Bassett, and Gausman to continue. They've had their ups and downs. You know, maybe they're not 100% of what they used to be, but you still need those guys to really, for so many reasons, for the pitching staff, for the bullpen, just for the overall health of this team, you need those three.
100%. We're going to step away, but we want to thank Christian Ryan for producing. I want to thank all of you for listening. Hope you're enjoying the baseball. The Blue Jays are playing as well as they have all season. So pretty good time to be a fan. We'll see if it can continue against the Phillies and Twins here. But until next time, for Ben Nicholson-Smith, I'm Arden Zwelling. This has been At the Letters.